Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Criminals are sent to prison to learn a lesson. We'll talk about literal lesson learning for prisoners in just a couple of moments. But first, it's hard to imagine how difficult a journey it was for 19th century American pioneers traveling west by wagon on the Oregon Trail. Difficult unless you read author Rinker Buck's book detailing his journey by covered wagon along the same route some 4 years ago. Buck traveled by mule-drawn covered wagon with his brother and a Jack Russell Terrier. They left from outside St. Joseph, Missouri for Oregon, following the still very visible ruts carved into rock and mud by the tens of thousands of original pioneers, a trip of 2,000 miles. The book is The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. It blends a personal adventure with insight into this important chapter in our history. Rinker Buck joins us in the studio. Rinker, it's so nice to meet you.
It's great to be here, Don.
I thoroughly enjoyed the book.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I have to tell you, one of the things that I enjoyed most about it was that you intertwined your personal adventure of just a couple of years ago with the history of the 1850s, in the middle of the 19th century. So what are you, first and foremost, an adventurer yourself or a historian?
I would say a historian. It was really interest in the history of the trail and how much different it was, the actual history than the myths that are passed down to us as school children, that moved me. And then because there's all kinds of things that are fascinating about the trail that you're not going to get even in a college course. Women played a hugely important role in trailblazing, and I write about that. The Indians were very friendly until the United States government made the highly intelligent decision to remove their protein source. You know, it became our policy to destroy the buffalo so that we could farm and ranch in the area. Then they became hostile. That's a very different equation or way of arriving at a stereotype than what you get in the Hollywood movies and so forth. They were terrible environmentalists and all that kind of thing. They were fleeced by the outfitters along the Missouri River right here. But I didn't think that would be anything more than just a regular old history book written from the perspective of a library until I ran across a line in one of my history books. No one has made a documented crossing of the Oregon Trail since 1909. And I grew up on a horse farm. I had a brother who's even better horseman than me. Never worked with mules before, but we figured that out. And it was very simple. We just said, buy some mules from the Amish. We found an old restored 19th century covered wagon in Kansas. And we mated them together. They were only about 90 miles apart. And it was simple to do until we actually left. And then it very rapidly ceased being simple. But no, it was driven more by a love of history than a love of adventure. But it was quite a adventure to get there.
You know, what's interesting about this history and the fact that most of us didn't and haven't known all that much about the trail. I was talking to some of our younger staff members yesterday. They learned about the Oregon Trail in a video game. That's
right.
Where most of the information came.
Right, and that's a deficiency, you know. It's my belief that you can't really understand the country we're in and actually be satisfied and accept all the problems we have. I'm in the territory close to Ferguson and all that it's unleashed nationwide. Well, if you go back and really understand your history, not just the myths that are passed down in, eighth grade sociology class, you understand that we were always a fractious society. We were a society founded, a country founded on religious freedom, and all religious freedom released us to do was to fight incessantly between religions, which was a big motive driving people to the trail, by the way, in the 19th century. So I just think it's incredibly important to confront the actual history that occurred for us, because all the antecedents to the conflicted society we are today are there. But if you read just the myths, the rights of man and George Washington wanted to, create a freer society or anything. No, he was a huge landowner. He was the largest landowner in America. And he wanted to get rights to his land from the British Crown was also a motive. You need to know that, and that's what we don't teach. So that was a big motive for the book.
You call yourself early on in the book a rut nut, and apparently there are a lot of them out there.
Yeah.
But you call yourself that, and you were interested in the trail since you were a very young man. What compelled you to make this trip?
I think it's just that an understanding that obsession is good. Obsession takes you places. And as a newsman over the year, I was always the kind of guy in the newsroom they'd go, well, a submarine is just sunk in Russia and they're trying to get the men out. And unfortunately, there's no local angle. And I would be the kind of guy to go, oh, there's a great local angle. One happened right here, that the Squalus in 1947, and they got the men out. And all the editors are scratching their heads, go, where does Ringer get this stuff? And I ended up getting a great story that day. The point is that just became obsessed with the trail because I knew that the more I peeled away at the layers, the more I could learn and teach people. But I also had a lot going on in my personal life. I'd just been divorced. Like most divorced guys, you know, all my new friends were fun people to be with, shall we say, in the bars. Mm-hmm. I was working at the Hartford Courant, which was a great newspaper and has now been basically slowly whittled away to nothingness and insignificance by all the budget cuts and everything. So I had a personal moment. I was in my 60s. I'd always been a writer. I'd done a lot of books and everything, but I just needed this new oomph, and it was an adventure.
And of course, you were with your brother Nick, mm-hmm. who was a quite different personality, and his dog, and mm-hmm. three mules. I want to get back to Nick and some other parts of, but I have to tell you, the heroes of this story.
So you like
forgive
the mules.
Me. Yeah. The heroes of the story were the mules.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot about mules from the book, too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, there's a nice chapter in the book about the history of the mule, and I relate it to the history of the U.S. Without the mule, you don't have the U.S. It wasn't only their service in the Civil War, World War I, World War II, Afghanistan. Very useful animal if you're going over mountains and that sort of thing, better than a vehicle. But they built the canals. They built our transportation system and everything. And so I have a whole long history of the mules from the day that George Washington actually first brought them mm-hmm. into the country. But the big thing I learned on the trip, and, you know, 60 years old, I take this trip, I finally learned body language. You know, because I'm a guy. You know, and women go, Rinker, I can tell from your body language that you're being hostile to me right now. And I'm going like, I don't have body language. There's no such thing as body language. You know, oh, you're such a man. I learned so much from this trip that when the mules were unwilling to do something or they were a little trepidatious and we had to be really careful with them and so forth, you see it in their bodies. You see it in their ear movements and so forth. Olive Oil came along. She's this great, lovable Jack Russell Terrier. She ran circles around me whenever I had to scout ahead of the wagon to find the trail. And she got rid of all the prairie dogs, which scared the mules, and all the rattler snakes. So I just it's a funny thing to say, but that's what I learned, body language.
Well, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on the mules, but mm-hmm. they're very much smarter than I ever thought they
yes.
were and much more intuitive
right.
than I thought they were.
Right. But, mules have been just maligned because they're ornery and this. Not, no, they're not ornery. They're different from a horse. They actually have a larger cranial capacity, and they're much more agile and athletic. For instance, they get from the burrow side of them a peripheral vision of 270 degrees. They can see their rear feet.
Yeah.
A horse can't. And that's very important because then you know that they're very agile in different terrain situations. So you expect more of them. So you're asking more of them. But the mule also gets from the burrow side a very strong self-preservation instinct. So what happened in history, the horse would say, okay, I'll do it and walk right over the cliff for you. The mule goes, I'd like to examine this a little bit, you know. And so what happens is the blockhead who's driving that mule whips them, this and that. And eventually they get tired of being abused for being smart. So they rebel, they kick, they run away, whatever. So I did a lot of reading about the mules before we left, and we got into some very tight situations where it really was perilous, crossing bridges and that sort of thing. And instead of whipping, it was a temptation to whip them, you know. But I said, nope, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to talk to them. And it just worked out great.
You know, lest people think that what we're talking about here is a easily discernible trail from St. Joseph, Missouri mm-hmm. to Oregon. It may have been at one time, but mm-hmm. You had asphalt to contend with and
yeah.
ranches, and it's only partially there, really, isn't it?
About 1,000 miles of the trail is now paved, two-lane blacktops, pretty remote areas, though, like Highway 30, Highway 36 through Nebraska, that sort of thing. But you still see, even on those roads, the prospect and the vistas that the pioneers saw. And it's unbelievably how much of it is still intact. All the pioneer encampments, like Rock Creek Station or Independence Rock, Chimney Rock. All the pioneer encampments are still there. Many of them are state parks now, that sort of thing. And then there's about another 1,000 miles that is unimproved ruts, unchanged ruts. From Casper, Wyoming to Cokeville, Wyoming, 350 miles. We spent 3 weeks traversing that. It's just the original two-track ruts.
That seems almost impossible to comprehend, except mm-hmm. that there were hundreds of thousands of people who made that trip along essentially the same route.
Yes, and as I explained in the book, the trail grew organically. So after its trail years, it became a cattle-driving trail. They paved it over sections of it during World War One, because we had all these soldiers over in Europe. We had to process a lot of beef to keep them alive. And so it became sensible to pave the trail so we could take the beef now by truck and that sort of thing. But the other thing I point out in the book that's really important, and this area here epitomizes it, this was called the Junction Country. There were dozens of trails, the Independence Trail, the Santa Fe Trail, the St. Joe Road, etc., all leading up to the main junction of the Oregon Trail, which is actually near Marysville, Kansas. But the trail wasn't a single set of ruts that you just got on in Independence and rode across. It was a collection. Overall, the trail was an avenue that followed the Platte, the Sweetwater, the Bear River west.
That was important to follow the rivers.
You had to stay on the rivers. Yeah. And the rivers, with the cholera epidemics, the river was both a preserver and a destroyer of the pioneers, because it turns out the Platte River was an ideal host for the cholera bacteria.
And thousands, thousands, I guess, died from cholera.
20,000.
20,000.
Yeah, along the trail. So, but it was great to get into this kind of thing and describe it in the book so people can understand. It wasn't the Oregon Trail. It was a collection of trails that everyone took to California and Oregon.
I have to take a break, but we mm-hmm. had a guest on the program a couple of weeks ago who wrote a book. Peter Stark was his name. Mm-hmm. Wrote a book called Astoria.
Yes.
John Jacob Astor, back in 1810, sent an mm-hmm. expedition to Oregon. And he claims in his book that that was the original Oregon Trail, that they set the, if you will, the guideposts for the Oregon Trail.
Absolutely accurate. Yeah. The pioneers followed the fur trapping trail out through South Pass and then up through Idaho. And indeed, the first white woman to cross the trail, Narcissa Whitman, who opened the trail up for the rest of Americans because there was a great fear and a great prejudice about women and children crossing, she followed a fur trapping caravan, and that's how she got across.
Right. And her story goes on in the book. We won't reveal exactly what happened there because
right.
it's we want folks to read the book. We are talking with Rinker Buck. He is the author of The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. That's what we're talking about. We will continue to do so. If you'd like to get into this conversation, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you would prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on Air. Back with Rinker Buck in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Rinker Buck. We can't get to everything I would like to talk about today, Rinker, but folks can
sure.
get more of you if they mm-hmm. choose to, and I hope they do, at Left Bank Books at 7 o'clock tonight. That's Left Bank Books on Euclid. You'll be talking about the book with a PowerPoint presentation, did you say?
Yes.
Good. It's going to be most interesting, I'm sure. Back to your story. One of the things that struck me about it was how helpful people were to you and your yeah. brother Nick and Olive Oil and the Three Mules mm. along the way. And it was extraordinary.
Sure. Well, I've traveled the West a lot already, particularly rural areas. And there is a natural generosity and hospitality of spirit. It's just part of the Western tradition. So that's always there. But I think if you come through with a covered wagon with a big American flag flying on the back, and the thing, it just opens a lot of doors. And the thing that impressed so many people, and I was glad they were impressed by it because it was something that we worked at. I had no motorized support. I consider that phony. You know, you can pay $1,000 and go out to Wyoming and an outfitter will take you 10 miles along the lander cutoff. And then at night you camp and there's an air-conditioned RV and, you know, showers and all catered sure. meals. I don't believe in that. And so we would get somewhere and the rancher would say, well, where's your motorized support? Where are your trucks? And we said, we don't have any trucks. This is it. We're doing it just this way. And at that point it was, well, just come on right in, you know. I think they were just impressed and they wanted to be part of the effort.
And they were descendants of the, to many cases.
Many of them, yeah. I would say it's extraordinary. The theme of the trip is how much is still there. All the original pioneer encampments are there and you just roll right in with a wagon and camp. And I would say an average of probably 40 to 50% of the ranches that we stayed on were the descendants of the original homesteaders who founded those ranches in the 1870s, 1880s.
Some of them apparently knew you were coming, too, kind of expected you.
Yeah, there's kind of like a cell phone or whatever you would call it, samizdat. That's the term that was used in Russia to describe the sort of underground newspaper that people... it could even be they would be riding out to look at their cattle that day, and they run into their neighbor, you know, on the edge of their ranch, and there's people coming through in a covered wagon, you know. So... the ranchers know what's coming.
Yeah. Well, and they were so very hospitable to you. A couple of other things I want to get to because they're important to the story. Weather. Mm-hmm. You encountered the same kinds of storms the original pioneers must have encountered. And the rivers. I mean, we've talked about how important they were, but they were tough to ford as well.
Yeah. You are staring across the mic in your studio at the biggest chucklehead in America right here. All right. Why would I leave and not check the weather? You know, and it was all there in the Pioneer Journals. And it turns out that a departure in May from a jumping off town like St. Joe or Weston, Missouri, positioned you ideally for green grass for the first 500 or 600 miles or so. However, which you needed as forage for your draft animals. However, in May and June, the Platte River Valley in Nebraska is the most inclement atmosphere you can possibly find, just violent, violent thunderstorms. And so the big problem we had with them was rushing for shelter. The mules panic when they're still in harness when lightning starts going off because they want to exercise their natural ability, their natural instinct to flee. So we had to get them into a barn real fast, whip off their harness, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not always easy to do that when a thunderstorm is bearing down on you. And then the rivers were quite a challenge. We had a lot of creeks and streams that were, it was a very high water year, 2011 when we crossed. That was quite a challenge to get across. When we got to the bigger rivers, because we didn't have a bigger covered wagon train with us or motorized support, we would just cross on the bridges, which interestingly were usually right where the original pioneer fords were. We weren't trying to reenact and prove anything that way. And, of course, then we get up on the top of the bridges, and the first few times the mules panic there because they're agoraphobic. There's nothing in their DNA that says to them, oh, it's okay to be 150 feet above a river and walking across. They don't get that concept. Mm-hmm. So they panicked, and the traffic was coming the other way, and they thought the mules were rearing up and running sideways and trying to get away from us. Because they were like mules in a circus or something. So they're stopping to take pictures and with flashes, which panicked the mules more. So we had quite a – it was as tough for us to get across the rivers a lot of times as it was for the pioneers.
Yeah, you didn't have a whole lot of regard for the RV drivers.
No, the RV drivers are just – I mean, first of all, you're going to go out and see America and camp and, you know, have an experience – so leave your house behind. You know, you don't have to tow it behind you in the vehicle. But they would stop on the side of the road and want to take pictures and block our way. And I mean, I just have some fun. My book is a series of observations about America if you happen to follow the original route of emigration west, the Oregon Trail, and what you can't avoid. During the summer in America is the elderly people in the RVs. And so I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. The jumping off place for the trip basically was Western Missouri. Mm-hmm. But what was St. Louis's role? I mean, was it an outfitter? How exactly did it
play? St. Louis played a huge role. First of all, St. Louis was the original fur trapping capital, really. You had to bring all the furs through St. Louis to get them down to New Orleans to trade. So St. Louis established itself as the place that you had to travel through. on the Mississippi River steamboat system, which basically started to come forward in the 1840s and 1850s at the same time that the Oregon Trail started. Everybody had to come up on the steamboats. All the river towns of the Midwest, Chicago, Moline, South Bend, any place that had a river access became very important for manufacturing because it was very cheap and efficient to send everything on the river, just like today. So a lot of your major wagon manufacturers, like Weber and Dam, there was a spade company, and I forget their name now, but you can go look it up. They made all the spades for the gold rush in 1849 in St. Louis.
Of course, that's what was taking place at this part of our history, to the gold rush.
Added to traffic to the trail a lot. So as a manufacturing center, St. Louis played a huge role in the trail traffic because they were making the things that everybody needed, like iron wheels and stuff, to get across the trail.
A couple of things I just want to touch upon because there's, as I said earlier, so much to talk about in so little time. The original pioneers were quite the litter bugs. That surprised me, too, the amount of junk that they deposited along the way.
Well, read my book, and you'll sort of be slapping your knees a little bit about how the America of today, the mythic America of the pioneers' days, of then, excuse me, reminds you of the America of today, okay? Yeah. So what happened was the outfitters along the Missouri River would play a lot of scare tactics on the pioneers and say, you know, you need a bacon barrel, you need a whole 50... whatever it is, a pound barrel of bacon for each kid, you know. And the kid's going to be like Baby Huey by the time he gets to Oregon. The pioneers, their draft animals will start to give out just within 2 or 3 days. Their wagons were overloaded, so they'd throw this stuff out. And then the outfitters, the merchants, would come behind and sneak behind the ridges in their own wagons, knowing full well that the pioneers were going to throw everything out. Load it all up as soon as the wagon disappeared over the hills and went back to Weston or St. Louis or St. Joe, wherever they were located, and resold that barrel of flour or bacon to the next group of suckers coming along.
Nonetheless, there was enough stuff along the trail that people could follow the trail just by following the debris.
So what happened is, and it's in countless Pioneer Journal, and I spent a huge amount of time with the Pioneer Journals and quote them in the book, is countless pioneers said you could navigate all the way to Oregon or California just following the debris field. In the book, I call the Oregon Trail America's first Superfund site.
Well, I can imagine what that must have looked like, maybe I can't, but I kind of think that I can. Another thing that I wanted to get to is what happened to the wood from the wagons once they got to their destination.
Oh, isn't that fascinating?
I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. So there was this great cycle of America then that established the antecedents for how we live today. It's a tremendous waste, then recycle. So you had a huge need in cities like Sacramento, Portland, Oregon City, and so forth to build things because, you know, 25,000 new pioneers were coming through Portland every year. So saloons, libraries, houses, et cetera. And they didn't necessarily have the right wood out there, and they didn't have a milling system set up. But meanwhile, every year, 30,000 covered wagons were showing up. They would very often break apart the wagons and use them to make furniture, to make houses, to make flooring, to make wooden sidewalks, and so forth. So and you can go into antique stores in California, and it'll be appraised and say, original covered wagon boards. It may just be a marketing ploy, and maybe 1 in 10 of those placards are true, but it literally happened. This was a very old American tradition, by the way. In the 1820s, even earlier, all the flatboats that left St. Louis or Cairo, Illinois, or Pittsburgh or whatever, and went all the way down to New Orleans because that was our economic system. That's how we floated our products to markets, and these things were huge. All of those flatboats, once they reached New Orleans, were taken apart and used for building lumber.
Now, our time is just about up. One observation that you had that I think is worth mentioning here is your appreciation for what the U.S. government does, and you paint it in terms of people who think the government does too much. They should really recognize what, in fact, it does do.
We live in this era where it is depicted as a crime that the government actually collects taxes and that it actually spends money. I took a covered wagon across America and spent 4 months, made 79 camps. And almost every place we camped was an old pioneer encampment that had been protected by the government and preserved as open space. It's an example of responsible government expenditure, and we shouldn't be so quick to condemn.
One word answer. Would you do this again?
Yes.
Okay, Rinker Buck, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for the book. Once again, we'll point out that he will be signing the book and having a talk at Left Bank Books at 7 o'clock tonight. That's Left Bank Books on Euclid. We have excerpts of the book on our website where folks can get a taste of it. I would recommend it for whatever that is worth. And if you want to know what happened to the mules at the end of the trip, mm-hmm. you have to read Rinker Buck's book. It's a great story. The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. Coming up, a new twist on learning a lesson in prison. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.